welcome back to another week of and another month of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens, below the line, with all those movers and shakers, those film and TV makers, those producers, directors, writers, actors, cinematographers, costume designers, production designers, VFX gurus, composers, the sound mixers, sound editors, film editors, you name it, and I talk to them. Been doing a lot of talking lately, doing quite a few interviews right now for awards consideration. Earlier today, I just spoke with, I'm pre-recording this on Sunday night, guys, just so you know. Earlier today, I had a lengthy conversation with makeup artisan Donald Moet, who I love. He is much lauded and acclaimed in the industry. He had Oscar nominations for Dune. Now, his work in Tron Ares is superlative. I also spoke with that genius cinematographer, Jeff Cronenweth, about his work on Tron Ares, which is really, it's a very interesting film from a production standpoint. Why a lot of you aren't seeing it in the theaters or you're not being that kind to it, I don't understand. Because from a technical aspect, this film is close to flawless. But fascinating interviews with them. Tomorrow I'm going to be speaking with the genius re-recording mixer at Formosa Group, Ron Bartlett, who's responsible for the sound. One of the players in the sound that you hear in Tron Ares. So I'm very excited from a technical standpoint for the film and for these masterful craftsmen. And I can't wait for you to hear these interviews later over the next 2 weeks. But today, you know, it's already November. I can't believe it. There are a lot more movies yet to see, a lot more coming out, a lot to talk about, and a lot more filmmakers to chat with. And there's more chatting today as I extend the Halloween weekend a bit so we can talk about the documentary, The Spirit of Halloween Town, with filmmakers Bradford Thomason and Brett Whitcomb. Plus, you're going to hear my conversation with writer-director Matt Whitaker as he discusses the powerful and important film, Truth and Treason. But first, let's keep that Halloween feeling going strong with The Spirit of Halloween Town. Now, who of you out there hasn't seen or doesn't know about the utterly charming Halloween Town franchise? It became a Halloween staple from the moment it released back in 1998, with Debbie Reynolds starring as the magical grandma Aggie Cromwell, Kimberly J. Brown as Aggie's granddaughter Marnie, who just learned that she's a witch, she has magical powers, along with Judith Hogue as Aggie's daughter and Marnie's mom, Joey Zimmerman as Marnie's brother Dylan, and Emily Roski as their younger sister Sophie. So beloved was that film, it spawned three sequels. There are four films in the Halloween Town franchise. But it all started in the little town of St. Helens, Oregon, where the film, the original film, was shot. And now all these years later, Bradford and Brett return to St. Helens to discover how this picturesque town and its Halloween happy residents decided to capitalize on the town's starring role in Halloween Town. And now each year they invite tourists to come and celebrate the film and Halloween with them. Now, Brad and Brett are the perfect documentarians to bring us The Spirit of Halloween Town. You might already know one of their acclaimed documentaries, Butterfly in the Sky, about PBS, Reading Rainbow, and LeVar Burton. If you haven't seen that already, I encourage you to do so now, especially in light of the funding cuts for PBS and wonderful educational programming like Reading Rainbow. Their doc is just absolutely fantastic. So I was not surprised when that they are now bringing us the spirit of Halloween Town. And they've turned their cameras on St. Helens, documenting the colorful cast of characters that live there, with everyone from the Queen of Halloween Town. Yes, there is a woman who is the Queen of Halloween Town, to a former cheerleader, to the Klondike bar owner, and even the folks responsible for the Alien Museum. Yes, they have an Alien Museum that sprung up as the result of alleged alien sightings above the town some years ago. And they explore the legacy and the impact the film has had on the town. It's a charming character study. It captures the spirit of Halloween and Halloween enthusiasts, as well as small town disagreements and the drama that occurs when colorful residents disagree passionately. And boy, there are some interesting disagreements in St. Helens, aka Halloween Town. This is an artfully crafted documentary. It will entertain fans of Halloween Town, fans of Halloween, and fans of fascinating human behavior, of which there's some that's quite interesting. Now, I spoke with Brad and Brett on Halloween, just on Friday. I spoke with them to find out about the tricks and treats of the spirit of Halloween Town. Co-directing the film, Brad also served as editor while Brett was the cinematographer, highlighting the town's month-long preparations and breaking the film down with a weekly countdown of 4 weeks before, 3 weeks before, 2 weeks before, 1 week before, and then the big parade and lighting of the town pumpkin on Halloween. You know, they take us through the various events and the businesses, including commentary by multiple residents about the positive impact of this annual celebration on the businesses and the community's enthusiasm. And yes, as I mentioned, they also show us the flip side with some of the town's naysayers. And breaking down the making of the spirit of Halloween Town, Brad and Brett also talk about the local ghost hunter, and they interview the local ghost hunter and ongoing paranormal investigations, as well as a seance, which they film. And that all adds plenty of suspense. And Brad goes into great detail about his editing process here and the luxury that they had and the luxuries they didn't have. Also, with so many documentarians, you hear them say, well, I didn't know when to stop. I could have kept going. No, Brad and Brett, they knew there was a finite window here. This would stop when Halloween was over. Plus, they like to move on to their next subjects. So it's interesting to hear this quote-unquote confessional from filmmakers. And of course, they both talk about collaborating and working with the townspeople, following the events, as well as the importance of capturing authentic stories and always keeping the spirit of Halloween and Halloween Town alive. So, take a listen as Bradford Thomason and Brett Whitcomb talk about their new documentary, The Spirit of Halloween Town. Hey guys, I'm very happy to be talking to you about Spirit of Halloween Town on Halloween, hello. No less.
Hello.
I already watched Halloween Town earlier this morning, because it can't be Halloween without watching Halloween Town. And now the perfect companion to all of the Halloween Town movies is your documentary.
Nice.
I got so excited when I read about this and first heard about it. And I was like, Blair will tell you. I went nutso. I'm like, oh my God, a Halloween movie. Halloween Town movie. This is so interesting that the Halloween Town movies would actually prompt a city to do this. But more than that, prompt you guys to make a documentary about it. So I'm curious, what led you to want to make a doc about the city of Halloween Town?
Yeah, I think that for us it was about Halloween. We both grew up really loving Halloween, and you know, it's like our favorite holiday. And I think we always wanted to make a documentary about Halloween, but you know, we didn't have a clear idea. And then we found an article about St. Helens and how it transforms itself because of this Disney movie. And we were like, okay, we're interested in the people in this town who sort of, you know, deal with this and put this on every year. And we want to know their stories and kind of get the sense of their lives. And that's, you know, why we pursued it.
Now, how did you go about reaching out to the town? Did you just show up there, cameras in hand one day? Did you reach out to the city council in advance? Because once a town has experienced the filming of a movie, sometimes they're very hesitant to want anybody else back because they didn't have a good experience. So I'm curious about how you approach the town.
I think we first reached out to the company and the people that put on the event and just started talking to them about who we are, what we were just kind of, you know, formulating in our minds, just because, you know, when you start talking to people, you don't know in the early stages if this is going to pan out, but we were interested in it, and we needed to know if they were interested, and if there were threads in the town and there were people that seemed like it would be good to follow. And you know, we showed them our work, told them to watch our stuff, you know, and we're pride ourselves on, you know, really respecting the people that we make movies with. So, you know, usually if you watch our stuff and they come away feeling okay, you know, about it, and you know, no one ever expressed having any bad experience. I don't think that. Another thing is, like, there was only like one article or two articles about this event, so it was a little bit of an untouched thing too. There wasn't any videos about it really, or it didn't have a lot of information.
Mm-hmm. That's a good starting point for you. Now, do you remember what your first impressions were when you then showed up there?
I mean, it's interesting because it completely transforms the town for like a full month. So, you know, we get there and it's, you know, there's setup going on, and, you know, it's something that they develop all the way starting in the summertime. And I think, you know, we just were impressed by how seriously they took it all and how much work went into it. And of course, you know, the people of the town, you know, most of them really enjoy it, you know, for different reasons. Some people just love Halloween, and you know, St. Helens is already kind of a spooky place in its own way, so some people just like the vibes, and some people really enjoy it because it brings a lot of business to the town. So our reception overall was positive when we got there, and therefore it was nice to be able to jump in and start filming with people.
Well, and I love that you say that, because yes, while we have all the upbeat positivity and the benefits of doing this and the enjoyment of doing this, you did include some of the naysayers.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. You know, she especially, like, it was like most everybody that we interviewed was gushing about how much they loved it.
Mm-hmm.
So when we found, you know, when we saw the city hall meeting where there was somebody who was like, didn't like it, we definitely reached out and gave them an opportunity to, like, you know, do you want to have a voice in this movie that's opposing, you know, that doesn't like this, and tell us why? And, you know, they were eager to do that. And it was great, because it was like, you know, it was a nice contrast to, like, you know, because the business, like Brad was saying, the businesses around there, the coffee shops, the restaurants, it's great. But, you know, I don't know, like, there's houses right behind where it happens, and they block things off. And, I can understand both perspectives, you know.
You got an even deeper perspective from her when she is saying the Lord has protected her. Halloween is the devil's birthday. It's Satan's holiday.
Right.
That speaks volumes that she is definitely not part of the joy of the day. And in case she doesn't realize it, Satan doesn't have a holiday. But I love that you give us all of that. But importantly is you really provide us that backstory of their preparation. And you break this down essentially into chapters: 4 weeks prior, 3 weeks prior, 2 weeks prior, 1 week until Halloween, and Halloween. I love that because you're building some tension and suspense as we're watching this documentary and seeing these things unfold. And you also give us a great behind-the-scenes look. A lot of some of the problems with getting the Alien Museum, getting the tech to work to do a show.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Ghost Hunter interview and going into the haunted house. And a lot of time you spend on the Klondike Bar. That is a kick in the ass from beginning to end. That could be its own documentary, guys. How, and I am really surprised at how candid the bar owner was with you. Was that a surprise to you, especially given he's the owner, he came in, he wasn't like a townie, he's an outsider, makes all these changes, and then whether he realized or not about how powerful social media is, goes off the rails and causes problems. Were you surprised by that?
Well, the social media situation was definitely a surprise. Him sort of being candid with us, I think, is kind of part of what we do and what we strive for. You know, when we meet individuals in situations like this, and this was the same with our last film, Jasper Maul, and with every film we make, you know, we gain their trust, and it's sort of a reciprocal relationship. So, you know, they trust us, we trust them, and you start to get into a situation where that candidness comes out, and it just, you know, I don't know, there's just a connection, and there's a lot of truth, I think, that comes out. And so we weren't surprised that he was candid with us once it happened, because we had been, you know, shooting with him, and we felt comfortable with him, and he felt comfortable with us. But yeah, the actual drama of the social media drama itself was surprising, and you know, we just kind of stepped aside for a second and said, we should follow this, right? And it was like, yeah, let's follow this. So we just, you know, followed that narrative thread.
Yeah, and you even show 2 weeks prior, you're showing all the discussions about the situation, about him. He's being forced into public apologies, and he's mad that his staff isn't backing him up. And you're watching this, it's like a soap opera. But it was so fascinating.
It's nice hearing you talk about it like that, because it's like, we love all the nuances that you're talking about. So it's really nice that all that stuff came across in the film to you too.
Oh my God, it absolutely did. And I'm laughing as I'm watching this. And here you are trying to get ready for this big small town event. That's a huge event for them. And you're having to spend time dealing with this other issue. And it just puts a damper on things. But his whole attitude, I mean, you've got to laugh at it when he was mad at it, that his staff didn't back him up. And it's like, dude, I think that kind of tells everybody what we need to know about you. But in
Eric, he's great. He's the whole situation was, we were just along for the ride, and Holcomb is the sweetest guy ever.
Well, you can tell that he's a sweet guy, but he's got that streak up his back that really that took hold in some form. But it makes your documentary more interesting. So
I think part of the reason why we followed it is because for us it was an example of how, you know, having 50,000 people converge on your city at once and 2,000 people come to your restaurant, you know, in a single weekend can sort of, you know, put people off kilter a little bit. You know, I mean, we wanted to show the impact of Halloween Town on people, and this was part of his journey through that.
Well, and some of the great stuff that we also get to see, a lot that takes place, we get the drag show, the Halloween drag show, which you can see the faces of all the people that are there, and they're just loving it.
Mm-hmm.
We see, you even talk about, and let him talk about, remodeling the bar and the changes he made to the Klondike once he bought it and once he came in. And then you also counter that, and we get to meet the Queen of Halloween Town. And all of her little ducks that she hands out to the children in the Halloween parade, children with disabilities or with autism. Absolutely charming. But with her, we see behind her Queen of Halloween Town mask. And we see the pain that she's suffering and why She loves doing this so much. And her story, I think, is one of the most heartfelt ones that you really bring to life.
Thanks. Yeah, she's wonderful. She was really great.
Was it difficult to narrow down who you wanted to focus on and what? Because obviously, okay, we're focusing on the Klondike. There's so much happening there. You're focusing on the Queen of Halloween Town. We're focusing on the guys trying to ready the Alien Museum. We have the Ghost Hunter interview. That's another thing in and of itself. The whole haunted hotel and setting up surveillance cameras and motion detectors and hunting. That could be its own documentary as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then you give us Sandra, the former cheerleader, who's putting together that really cool routine for the current cheerleaders at the high school. And she's got a slightly interesting story. I would say over-exuberance, perhaps, because of the own shortcomings that she has in her life, having given up dance and cheerleading. So how did you pick these individual people? Once you had footage, were you structuring this, and after you looked at your footage, did you then say, hey, Sadra's got an interesting story here? Yes, even in the bowling alley when she's stressing with her boyfriend of 3 years. The Queen of Halloween Town when she is crying and she's upset about the loss of her mother. Did you know as you were shooting you would be including these in the film? Or did all of this, these selections come about in the editing process? And I guess this is really for you to speak to, Brad, having edited this film.
Well, first of all, thank you. You really watched the film, and it seems like you really kind of dove in, and I really appreciate it. I know we both do. I think that it's a combination of both. Like, we have an idea of people that we want to follow from the get-go, and then, you know, if we're lucky, and a lot of times it seems that we are, you know, they deliver good stories and have things in their lives that make for good film and that are affecting. And, you know, it's because we choose passionate people, I think, and that really helps. But then, you know, sometimes the stories just take us places that we can't anticipate. You know, obviously the situation with Holcomb that we just talked about is one of those situations. I mean, Sadra, you know, we kind of had a sense of what was going on in her life, but, you know, the way that the film plays out, and I won't spoil anything, you know, we didn't know how that was going to go with her and her sort of familial relationships. So we just kind of let it take us where it did. But, you know, as you're filming, I think those narrative threads either strengthen or they weaken. And there were a couple of people that we filmed with that didn't make it into the film because we didn't quite feel like they fit in, or their story didn't sort of wrap up in a way that felt satisfying. So it's just kind of all of it, really.
I love the selections that you made, and I love how you structured this from an editing standpoint. And you bounce us through. So we see part of it, and then something that's happening a week later or 2 weeks later, we come back to that. So you're building all of this interest, because once you start watching this, it's like, yeah, I want to see. Are there spirits? Is the hotel haunted? Is the Klondike haunted? Were there real aliens and real alien sightings? I want to hear more of this. Is Sadra going to perform again or choreograph? Or however her story plays out. And as you said, we're not going to do any spoilers. But the seance, the paranormal investigation, the medium who sees spirits, all of these things, you tease us and then you come back to it in the weeks as they go by and things intensify. I love that structure that you did, Brad.
Thank you. Really appreciate that.
How much footage did you guys shoot that you then had to cull through to do an edit?
I actually don't even know. I actually have no idea. We filmed a lot. You know, we lived there for a while. We had a Airbnb in a town, you know, close by, and we would just, you know, you build relationships with people so that they're calling you when things are happening. Like, that's the best scenario that could happen, is Sadra's calling us and updating us when they're practicing. Holcomb says, hey, I'm dealing with a crisis. I don't know if you're interested in this, or, you know, we get lucky enough to catch it on camera, which is what actually happened. And, you know, we just, I actually have no idea how much we shot, but it, you know, we are definitely, it's hard for us to leave, you know, a place. Like if mm-hmm. we're at somewhere filming, you know, it's like, we want to stay there until it's basically silent. And so we, you know, we have no problem with just rolling all day. And then, you know, luckily Brad was, you know, we'd look at the footage. We had the privilege of like looking at the footage in the, you know, when we got back to our Airbnb, and, you know, sometimes Brad would edit whole scenes like that night.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's a luxury that sometimes, you know, when you, aren't when it was, you know, if you're working with an editor or you hire someone after the fact, you're just dumping a hard drive on them, you know, with some direction saying, you know, here's what I'm thinking. And then they take a stab at it. There's a lot of ways to work with an editor or to, you know, structure your movie. But because we do almost everything, you know, Brad's doing sound, I'm shooting, we're making decisions together, we're, you know, he's living it. He's like editing in his head. So we'll be in somebody's room and, you know, we experience something, but before we leave, he'll like whisper, make sure you get like an exterior of the house, 'cause he's editing. And I'm just like, oh yeah, good idea. So I think just the relationship that we have working together, we're like a unit that's ready to like we can go somewhere and leave with what we need for what we're trying to achieve.
Mm-hmm. So often with documentaries, they're so open-ended. You could keep shooting. Here, you had a very definitive timeline. Is that a help or a hindrance to you? Do you get done and then wish you had more to shoot? Or once Halloween came, we had a parade, Halloween's over, that's good, we're fine, we're going to go now.
We like to move on. We like to finish our projects. We like to go to, just for me, I think Brad feels the same way, but we're glad to be, once we get what we feel like we need, it's good to go back and be, let's say we're done filming.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, two really big things that stand out in this documentary, in the spirit of Halloween Town, is the seance with Kathy and also the ghost hunter and going through the house. Did you ever feel like anything was being set up? Did you feel like this was all legit? What were your impressions being there, capturing this on camera?
I'll speak for me. The two things, I think. One, you know, I think that the things that the people in our film experience are things that they're actually experiencing. So mm-hmm. we're immediately connected to the people. Our whole goal in this is to channel our story through people in our film and how they're experiencing things. So, you know, we're almost less interested in the supernatural component and more interested in how it manifests itself in mm-hmm. the people that we're focusing on. So there's that. So I believe that, you know, what they're experiencing, and that's kind of full stop. I'll also say that, you know, it was kind of spooky in that building sometimes. And, you know, I heard some noises on a floor above me, and there was no one up there. And, you know, while you're in there shooting at 2 o'clock in the morning, getting B-roll and stuff, and, you know, it could be kind of unsettling in its own way. So that was my experience, at least.
Mm-hmm. With regard to, you know, being in the house and doing the ghost hunting in there, I'm curious, did you go in and set up your surveillance cameras and the motion detectors yourself, or did you rely on the ghost hunter and his cameras and you just get a feed from it?
Yeah, we just got the cards from those, and, you know, they're just rolling. So they're just, like you said, motion sensored. So we're just, you know, getting that from them. And, you know, every everything, like Brad said, everything they're experiencing. Nobody was trying to do anything, and, you know, they were, like, using their equipment and taking it very seriously, which we, you know, appreciated. Like, that was, like, that's like, we like to make movies. Their passion is what is that, is mm-hmm. trying to, you know, do investigations for people and to get people answers, or, you know, to see what's there, who's there. And, you know, I, like Brad said, our interest is, we're so interested in them, you know, mm-hmm. like what they're doing and their passion for it.
No, I was curious, because I didn't think you'd be dragging in all kinds of surveillance cameras and setting them up in all the rooms, because how would you know what room to put them in? So I'm glad that, you know, you just got the cards and you could do a dump of the footage and then see what you had. I do have to say, no spoilers going to be given, but Brad, the final 30 seconds or a minute of this doc, it is a killer ending. Killer! I was blown away by what you did. I just absolutely loved it. Love how you ended this.
That's awesome.
Thank you.
And that's something really that, everybody needs when they watch the film. They've got to watch it to the bitter end and do not look away, because you will jump out of your seat, and not necessarily because of what, of something scary, but because of how you just abruptly end this. And that just blew me away. I absolutely loved it. Loved it.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's awesome.
So I got to ask about Halloween Day. Halloween Day itself, you've got the parade. You have all the cute little kids out there. Was this a payoff for you guys to actually see all of these weeks come to fruition and have a very celebratory tone happening in all the cute little costumes?
We love that. That's part of what we love about Halloween, is just being out there in that crisp air at night and everyone's running around yelling, and it feels like a neighborhood, like a movie in a 90s movie where, you know, you're walking around a neighborhood and there's kids everywhere and there's black cats and there, you know, it's like, that's, we wanted to capture that. Like, we wanted that feeling that we love so much in movies and in real life when it's Halloween. It's just, there's a, you know, there's a community spirit of it all. And, you know, we made sure to spend time floating, walking down those streets, just getting, you know, capturing outfits and kids trick or treating. And, you know, so, you know, that was an, you know, it was extra special there because of, you know, the event.
I just love it. And it really felt like, you know, when it came time for the parade and Halloween and the lighting of the pumpkin, it really had that small town Disney movie feel. You really captured that. And enchanting is the word for that. When you brought that to life in real time and not in a Disney film. Just absolutely charming and wonderful. Now, I do have to ask you, do you know who did the makeup, the zombie makeup on all those cheerleaders? Because it's fantastic.
Yeah, one of the moms, like the kids did it them a lot of it themselves.
Wow.
But there was a mom amongst the one of the kids' moms was like a makeup artist or something. So there was somebody there that was like a kind of a pro that was helping them, which was, you know, like lovely for them. But yeah,
because their makeup was fantastic, really incredible.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, I understand you have a soundtrack for the movie. Did I hear that correctly?
At the moment, we've released, Mackenzie Stubbard composed our main theme and recurring theme, and so we've released that. It's on, you know, YouTube and Spotify and all the platforms. In terms of the full soundtrack, I do think there'll eventually be a score, maybe EP, and potentially a full soundtrack. It's just not out yet.
Mm-hmm. And what were you looking for musically as an undercurrent to this documentary?
I think that, you know, we wanted to sort of channel on one level, we wanted to channel the sort of orchestral energy of the classic Halloween movie. So that's kind of where
the theme comes from, you know, like creating our own theme that kind of feels like all of these classic Halloween movies and sort of, you know, spooky movies of the past. And then, you know, we use this sort of vintage library music for a lot of the score, and it has a real vibe to it because it's older, you know, it was recorded on tape and all kinds of things, so it has a feeling to it I think that modern library music doesn't. And I think we just wanted to maintain kind of a spooky sort of warm undercurrent to all of it.
On every level, you have done an amazing job with this documentary. I've always been a fan of your work, going back to Butterfly in the Sky, which I still think is one of the most wonderful docs, and it should be released now, again, given all the cuts to PBS and NPR and all of that. It's an important documentary, and I've always loved that. And now to see this, The Spirit of Halloween Town, it's great. It's great, guys.
Appreciate it.
And Blair is anxiously emailing me, "We have to wrap, we have to wrap." So I'm going to bid you an adieu and a happy Halloween, and I hope we get to chat again in the future.
Thank you so much. Appreciate your energy and everything, and thanks for watching the movie so closely.
Oh,
it means a lot.
Guys, thank you so much. And hopefully we will talk again in the future about your next one.
Yeah, sounds good.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that was Brad Thomason and Brett Whitcomb talking The Spirit of Halloween Town. And you can keep Halloween going a little bit longer for yourselves and watch The Spirit of Halloween Town on Amazon, Apple TV, and YouTube right now. So, I'm going to shift gears here, and I want to talk about an important and powerful film that's in theaters right now, Truth and Treason. I've briefly mentioned it the past 2 weeks, but this is such an important film, especially given the current political climate, that even though my interview with writer-director Matt Whitaker discussing the film has been on BehindTheLensOnline.net for a couple weeks now, I want to showcase it now on BTL radio show. Truth and Treason is based on the true story of German youths Helmut Hubner, Karl-Heinz Schneib, and Rudi Wabi, who fought Hitler and the Third Reich with the most powerful weapon of all, their words. Helmut was a writer and a wordsmith, and 16 years old. An amazing true story that has remained untold for too long, and now thanks to Matt and Karl-Heinz Schneibe, it comes into the light. Karl's own story, as Matt touches on in our interview, is shocking to say the least. No spoilers, because this is a true story, but all three boys were eventually arrested. They were tried in the German High Court. They were all found guilty. Helmuth was executed. Guillotine. And Karl and Rudi had imprisoned. Karl was pulled out of a prison and sent to war. It's just ending up in a Russian prison camp. The events of their lives are just too horrific. But Karl and Rudi survived. And they have made sure that Helmuth's work and his beliefs have not died. And luckily, Matt found his way to Karl, and this is the result of that. Now, the film is set as World War II is raging on. Helmuth is forced to confront a terrible truth. Loyalty to his country now means loyalty to a lie. He sees the lies that Hitler is spewing, that the Third Reich is spewing. When his trusted bishop of his church urges obedience to the Nazi regime, Helmuth begins to question everything. And after his Jewish friend Solomon Schwarz is taken away, this was a straw that broke the camel's back. Helmuth, along with Carl and Rudy, begin listening to band radio broadcast, and they launch a resistance, exposing the truth. But in a nation ruled by fear, defiance comes at a cost. And as the regime closes in on him, he must decide what it truly means to be a good German. As Matt breaks it all down for us in this interview, you're going to learn of the genesis of the film and what led him to this true story and how that led him to the idea of a film and then a script and ultimately what you will see on screen when you go to the theater and see this. As you'll hear, authenticity and historical accuracy were essential, which led them to real historical locations in Lithuania, which emotionally impacted the cast and crew, and which Matt goes into chilling detail about, as some of the actual cells and tunnels that they film in is where the Nazis held prisoners. And to hear him talk about seeing the names of these victims, of these men, with their name and a date scrawled into the concrete walls in these cells. Just to hear him talk about it gives you a chill. But he talks about capturing the right visual and atmospheric tone, such as the contrast of light and darkness and the physical constraints of tunnels and cells, and how that impacted metaphorically and visually this story. Calling on cinematographer Bianca Klein, together Matt and Bianca developed a visual grammar that was not only cinematic, but that captured and supported the emotion of each and every scene. As you'll also hear, Matt discusses the importance of this film, the courage of Helmuth Hubner and his friends, casting, performances, visual inspirations, authentic locations, set and design details, thematic use of light and darkness, symbolism, sound design by those master gurus at Formosa Group, Aaron Zygmunt's amazing score, not to mention the editorial challenges which, in addition to the film, gave way to a four-part series that dives even deeper into the real events, and which is now streaming on angel.com. So you can go see the movie in the theater. You can watch the four-part series on angel.com. This is an incredible must-see film. And it's a fascinating and emotional interview. So please take a listen as writer-director Matt Whitaker talks about truth and treason.
Hey, Debbie, how are you?
I am beyond thrilled to be speaking with you about Truth and Treason. This movie is fantastic.
Thank you.
Absolutely fantastic. You left no stone unturned. Your research just blows my mind for the authenticity here. Where did this start for you to choose Helmuth's story to turn into a film?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's been a journey. Back in 2001, I actually met the last surviving member of the Helmuth Hubner Resistance Group. If you've seen the film, Carl, his friend,
yes.
Carl. I met Carl Heinz Schnibbe when he was in his late 70s in 2001. And just asked him if he would share his experience with me at that time in my career. I was a documentary filmmaker, and he did, and I just said, I've got to share this story with the world. So I actually interviewed him and then did a bunch of research, interviewed every living person I could find who knew Helmuth, who knew those boys, and did a PBS documentary in 2002, and the story wouldn't let go of me. And I started finding more information after the documentary came out, more information about the Gestapo agent, Erwin Meusner. And mm-hmm. I was just fascinated to learn about this really complex, difficult character who did horrible things during the day and then was a loving and kind husband and father. Anyway, so I started writing the screenplay way back in
early drafts of the screenplay back in 2002, and then it's been a relentless journey to get this film on the big screen.
Wow. Well, it is a story, and I'm not surprised that Angel Studios is distributing this. For me, it ranks right up there with the Bonhoeffer film that they distributed. It's another story that needed to be told that most people did not know about. Was it always your intention to direct this, Matt?
You know, actually, when I first started writing the script, it wasn't. My writing partner, Ethan Vincent, and I had actually optioned the script to a big producer in L.A. who had a director attached, and we were just writing it. And then in 2005, every once in a while you have some of those singular moments in your life where you just kind of have an epiphany. And I definitely had one of those and realized that not only did I know this story better than anybody else, but I was the right one to tell it and the right one to direct it. So got the rights back to the script and really began in earnest in 2005, believe it or not, in trying to get this film made, put a package together. Had some real big stumbling blocks along the way. The world housing market collapsed and we lost all our financing. Went through another phase of getting it back in, almost set up, and then COVID hit and we lost again. And it was actually during COVID that we started having meetings with Angel Studios. And they loved the story. Ironically, two of the executives had seen my documentary way back when they were in high school and loved the story. And so from that point forward, it was just a matter of working with them, bringing the financing together, and then shooting the film.
Watching this film, the visuals are stunning. The visual grammar, the visual tonal bandwidth, your work with Bianca, who is an exceptional cinematographer. But before we can start shooting anything, we have to cast this film. You had the script done. You got a lot of people in this film. Granted, we have our primary people. We have Helmut. We've got Solomon for a big part of the film. We've got Rudy. We've got Carl. And, of course, we have SS Officer Irwin. Yeah. Where do you even start to cast a film like this?
You know, I knew that even though it's a German story, I knew I wanted to shoot it in English. I wanted to give it the best chance to get a wide exposure. But I also knew that it's a European story. So from the beginning, I really felt like we wanted to cast it out of the UK. And so that's what we did. We have a fantastic casting director, Sarah Trevis, who really, threw out the net, making great offers to get Rupert Evans in as our Erwin Meussner, the Gestapo agent, was just a coup. He's fantastic. But we all knew that every role had to be good, but Helmut, that lead, to find that young actor who could really carry the show was crucial. And finding young Ewan Horrocks was just a gift. That kid is so talented. I feel like he's the British Timothy Chalamet. He's got such depth, for any age, but he's in his early 20s now, and he's just such a fantastic young actor.
He just blew me away, and the way we see him, his character development, and what Ewan brings to this role. First, he's shy, he's carefree with his friends, but he's shy. He's not, he's smaller than the other guys, he's very lanky, but then we see him start when his best friend Solomon suffers and disappears. That's when we see a total shift in the character of Helmut, and it just grows and grows. And Ewan starts bringing such confidence to his performance, and not just in his delivery, but in his stance, the way he addresses other people. The way it develops this great stare, that he can stare down anybody. He will stare down a judge. He will stare down an SS officer, Gestapo. But we see that incrementally grow in the film. Just amazing.
Debbie, I'm so grateful that you recognize that, because it is definitely there. He has this incredible arc, both in his dialogue and performance, but but in his physicality as well.
Yeah.
And as you know, that film was shot all out of continuity. You know, it was we were shooting stuff toward the end at the beginning and stuff at the beginning toward the end, and he just was locked into that arc to be able to see that progression, you know, over the course of the story. Yeah.
I was riveted to that and what Ewan was doing. And no matter who he was playing against, as we see him playing against his scenes opposite his stepfather.
Yeah.
And even his friends. Carl and Rudy are very hesitant. They're, especially Carl. But I love how you have structured this and how the events unfold and unfolded in real life is that it took pivotal moments to push the boys into resistance, to push them. And I love seeing that happen because it's a great lesson and a great illustration for people today. Because very much we're in a similar situation now as the world was and Germany was back in the 1930s and 40s. So to see a catalyst, one event, be it getting chased down a street, hiding, trying not to be found. All it takes is one element to get the ball rolling, and you really bring that to life here. And the boys, their personality comes through and feeds into that. And that's very tricky. And kudos to you and to them on conveying that so brilliantly.
Thank you. Yeah, that was the casting. You know, we did some chemistry tests when we were casting in London. And it was very clear that these boys, the four boys, as I affectionately refer to them, were, you know, they just almost immediately really bonded. And then a week before production began, we brought them in for a week of rehearsals. Mm-hmm. And of course, we were working on scenes and those kind of things. But really, it was about just enforcing and reinforcing and strengthening their chemistry, their friendship. So that by day one, when we started shooting, they were so tight, and they still are. A year and a half later, they just hang out together. The three of the boys are hanging out in L.A. right now.
Oh, wow.
Hanging out together. Yeah, they're just so tight. And you can just, but that comes across so powerfully, I feel, in the film. You can just feel, you know, from that first scene on the bridge, when they're just boys having fun, to their final goodbye, you know, it's... you see this incredibly powerful arc, but undergirding all of that is this deep friendship and love for each other.
And you truly, during the trial scene, you hammer that home with just one ECU, just one small shot of Carl's hand and helmet. That's all it takes to hammer home the depth of their friendship. It made me cry. It truly did, Matt. Now, once you have this amazing cast in place and you're going to shoot, your locations are beautiful. You have some complex locations that, for Bianca's purposes, probably were not the easiest in the world. Talk to me about your conversations with Bianca and designing the visual grammar here. Because we've got the city hall, we've got archive rooms that are dark and dank and very narrow corridors, we've got tunnels underground. This is complex visually.
Yeah, and Bianca, before production, of course, Bianca and I spent a lot of time watching films and looking at photographs, and she had found some just beautiful black and white photos from a Russian photographer from back in the 30s. And of course they were black and white, and we weren't going to shoot a black and white film, but we wanted to capture that feel and the way that the light coming through the windows kind of bloomed, just emphasizing or recognizing the importance of the darkness in the images, which made the light even more important, more beautiful. Which that chiaroscuro in the way we shot it carried across even thematically into the film. You know, the importance of feeling the reality of the darkness of what these boys were going through,
mm-hmm.
so that when the light came and when there's light at the end and when there's hope, it's that much more powerful, you know. And I just loved the way that Bianca took that discussion that we had, took that, you know, aesthetic and cinematic approach and just embraced it. And so every scene that we were in, and to your point, yeah, a lot of those places, when you see those cramped tunnels that they're walking down and some of those cells that they're in, those were actual locations in Lithuania that the Nazis and the Gestapo had held people prisoners. You know, some of those locations were real locations, and you could feel it when we were shooting there. That the final goodbye scene with the three boys,
mm-hmm.
in that room, Jews had been held, murdered. There were scrapings on the wall. People had scraped in their names and the date, and we're shooting right next to it, and you could just feel it. It impacted the way I directed the scene. It impacted the performances. It impacted the way that Bianca lit it and shot it. It was just an incredible experience filming in Vilnius, Lithuania, which had a horrible history with the Nazis, and then of course after that with the communists. And so, yeah, very powerful locations and an incredible cinematographer who made the most of every single one of them.
She sure did. And I have to say, the lighting in the tunnels and in the cells and the light bulbs that you're using there, it just really creates that sickly yellowish pallor. That right there, it makes you want to gag. You know it's a horrible place. And then in City Hall, you've got the beautiful windows in City Hall with light coming through and some really interesting angular shots, such as Helmut's boss looking down onto the work floor. You really get the big brother is watching you sensibility and the cloak and
that's
dagger.
That's based on historical fact. That's based on historical fact. Carl talked to me about how that room was set up where Helmut worked, and that his boss did have that window up above where he would look down on people. And so I took that tidbit of geographical history and worked it into the scene. And then, of course, you know, importantly, worked it into those crucial moments, you know, with Helmut being seen there, you know, at that crucial moment in the story. So I loved that as well. That was a set that was built within an old music conservatory in the heart of Vilnius, Lithuania.
Oh, wow.
Which had kind of fallen into disrepair. And our incredible production designer, Jurgita, she's got a beautiful Lithuanian last name, Jurgita Vergilaitė. Jurga, we called her, and she was just unbelievable. The best production designer I've ever worked with by far. And she's the best production designer. They say she's the best one in Lithuania. She's the best one, I think, in Europe. She's just incredible. And she made that set just shine. So down to the most minute details. Amazing work.
I have nothing but compliments to say for Jurgita. That set is, and it's not just that set, but that one in particular, because it is so key. And the room is so large, which here again, Bianca makes use of the whole room, but the claustrophobic nature of all the desks on top of one another,
mm-hmm.
and the staircases,
yes.
and going down into the archives below that are so dark and narrow, and the dark woods and books and papers and no lighting. And it's all, it fits so beautifully and speaks volumes about things hidden. You know, spying on people, knowing everything, and then hiding the truth.
Yeah.
Just brilliantly done. Now, we talk about everything that, all the details that are put in there. I have to bring up all the old Remington typewriters here, Matt.
And where did those come from?
Nobody came to me here in California to get my Remington typewriter that goes back to the 1940s. That was my dad's. I've got one. There's still one or two at my dad's house in Philadelphia.
Oh, my goodness. You and I need to talk. I've got a typewriter fetish as well.
And I doubt if Tom Hanks lent you any of his collection of typewriters. So, you know.
No, but you can be sure we talked about that.
I bet you did. But I'm curious, yeah. And it's not just the typewriters. I mean, granted, all the different models of Remingtons that you had, but also the importance of the sound. And my boys at Formosa, whom I love dearly, Mr. Zub and his compatriots.
Yeah, Duncan McRae and Anthony Venturi. Yeah, they just killed it.
They are beyond reproach. But to hear the sound of the different typewriter keys, because each typewriter does make a different sound.
Yeah.
When you hit those keys. And then layering that in with Aaron's beautiful score. But the sound design of bringing in the music, the footsteps on the cobblestones as they're running at night, or even just the slow walk after the operetta, and even the balance of the operetta and the dialogue. The sound, and for me, it started with hearing the different typewriter keys.
Yeah. If I can just there, you know, when I had my first meeting with Formosa, I kind of laid out my vision for the soundscape and talked to them about it in three levels, you know, the first being just kind of the sounds that we're aware of, you know, that the viewer is aware of, that they're hearing. And then there was a second level of sounds that are just on the edges of our awareness, you know, what's going on outside the window, what's going on in the city there, what's going on down the hall outside the room where this scene is taking place. And then even a level below that, there are sounds that are woven into the fabric of the soundscape that are only meant to be there on a subconscious level. There are certain rhythms. There's a very important rhythm in the film. It's built into even the logo of the film, where it's a dot, 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 dash.
Yep.
The V for victory.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that. And so, you know, you hear, you know, when he turns on the radio, the BBC, you hear that, you know, bup, 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 bum, that dot, 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 dash. And that rhythm, that bup, 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 bum, is in crucial places throughout the film that Anthony and his team at Formosa, that we work to craft that in there, again, just to be on a subconscious level. But it's at important moments throughout. And specifically, to your point, the typewriter sound, we talked about that once Helmut starts his resistance movement, that's his weapon. That, you know, his weapon is the typewriter. And so laced into some of the typewriter sounds, there is just a bit of a shotgun or a bit of, a gunfire that goes into some of those, especially in his first typing montage to, you know, where he's typing to Mendelssohn. There's gunfire that's in with each keystroke, you know. So just that kind of artistry going into the sound design is just wonderful.
Oh yeah, the sound design is just flawless here, and it speaks volumes. It really does. Aaron's score, some of the motifs during the typing montages are very very specific. And have more of a military bent to a degree that captures that whole idea of Helmut's typewriter being his weapon. Just amazing. Now, how challenging was the editing process on this one, Matt?
it's been, well, you know, we wrapped mid-July and just finished editing the... And I don't know if you know this, but it's both a feature film and an extended limited series. And I can tell you more about that if you want to hear it.
Oh, yes, please.
We shot a four-part limited series last year. That's what we shot for 50 days. We shot four episodes. We shot them as one big feature, you know, but we shot 4 hours of content, essentially. And then our distributor, Angel Studios, they had a couple of their executives that came over to Lithuania while we were filming. And they saw the incredible stuff that Bianca was getting. And they said, this belongs in theaters. You know, we've got to put this out in theaters. Is there a two-hour version of this film or of this series? You know, is there a two-hour film here? And so when we got back and our editor, Adam Banks, is our editor on this incredible editor, He just dived in and we put together just kind of a big 4-hour everything all in one version to see where we stood. And then from there we started saying, okay, what is there a 2-hour version? And that film you saw is that 2-hour version, which I'm just still amazed. It works so incredibly well. And there's so much more in the extended 4-part series. So that was, once we finished the 2-hour version, then we went back and then finished each of the four episodes. And each one is, you know, about 45 minutes long.
I hate to tell you this, but I would have been happy if you had given me a 4-hour feature film.
That's so kind of you to say.
That is how much I love Truth and Treason as it is now. But when I see how the story being told, I know there is more to it.
Yeah.
I would have been perfectly happy to sit and watch a 4-hour feature film.
I'll tell you what, we just couldn't get our distributor to say, we couldn't convince them that people wanted to watch a 4-hour movie from an unknown director. But to your point, I'm so grateful because they said, look, let's do both. Let's do the 2-hour movie and then let's let people stream and dive deeper into Helmut's story, into the story of Meissner and his family. We only just touch on some things there, the story of his bishop and his, you know, his family and his reasons for what he did, into Helmut's mother. Oh my goodness, her true story and the story that we shot with her is just, you know, it's just so powerful. So I'm excited for people to experience the theatrical version and then want more, and then go to Angel, go to Angel's, you know, streaming app and watch it, you know, and really immerse themselves even further in the story.
His mom, you know, there's more to this story because the boys are, none of them are too impressed with Hugo as Helmut's stepfather. He's military. We see him decked out in his finest regalia. Interestingly, he does not wear that during the trial. He wears civilian clothes during the trial. But his mother...
I'm so glad you noticed stuff like that.
Oh, my God. The devil is in the details, Matt.
That's right.
And
that's right.
I'm looking at the whole gallery in the trial. And, of course, earlier, Hugo was so adamant with Helmut, he's not to tell his mother, just get out of the house and blah, blah, blah. And his poor mother, she's always so quiet. And she's very... She cows down to whatever Hugo wants, more or less.
Yeah.
But she has a couple moments where she reaches out through the bars, the barbed wire,
to
touch her son's face in prison, with the guard telling her no touching, and she looks for a moment. And those little things, there's more to mom than we see in this film.
Yeah, and when you get to see the series, you'll see that her story. I had to call Joanna Christie, who plays, just beautifully plays the part of Emma, and just say, look, you're important in this film, but we've had to cut out some things to go from a 4-hour, you know, series to a 2-hour movie. She was so graceful. She came over for the premiere in Utah and in LA. But she knows that her performance in the series is even so much, you know, broader and deeper.
When it comes to German families, my dad was first generation United States. My dad's entire family came from Germany. Mm. The majority are still there. But I know how German mothers are because I know how my grandmother was with my dad. They do not sit quietly by.
Yeah, and that's what you get more of in the series. There's I don't want to spoil it for you, but there is a scene between Emma and Hugo. Because you get to see, you know, she is this woman who, and Chris, Joanna and I talked about this, is that, you know, she's a single mom for years. And so she finally gets a man who's got a good job and he loves her and he's not a really very good, loving dad and to her son, especially Helmut, but she's kind of trying to make the best of it, you know. But she comes to a place where... she makes sure, as a German mom would, she makes sure that he knows how she feels and how things are going to change. Glimpses of that in the film, but we get more in depth.
I picked up on those glimpses immediately, based on my own grandmother. But I'm curious about the radio broadcast. Did you actually, you and the guys at Formosa actually get some real broadcasts from the day, or did you recreate all of those for the shortwave?
A little of both. So we were able to take, actually, ironically, one of our best sources for verbatim, you know, text from those BBC broadcasts are from some of Helmuth's leaflets. Because he would, you know, he was writing a lot of his own thoughts and pulling from, you know, various authors, band authors and stuff. But he was also, because he knew shorthand, you know, taking notes and transcribing word for word or very close to it BBC broadcasts. And so a lot of those things that you hear the BBC saying in that are actually pulled from other leaflets that actually Helmut had written.
Wow.
And we pulled it from that. And then we did also just put some things in there, either from other actual BBC broadcasts, or did some, you know, a little bit of creative work and saying, oh, let's just shorten this down and hear them say this. Yeah.
Wow.
But I should point out as well that every single word that you hear Helmut speaking from his leaflets or see him typing, those are actually from leaflets that the real Helmut Huebner typed. Of course, he typed them in German, and so these are English. But that's exactly what they, you know, those words that you hear that young man saying, those were written by the real Helmut Huebner.
What about the speech at trial that he gives?
Yeah, so we don't have the transcripts of what that is. So my sources were what Carl told me personally. This is what he remembered that Helmut said, and what Rudy reported that Helmut said. And there's overlap between those, but there are also some distinctions. And then from that point, again, we pulled from some things that Helmut had written in some of his other leaflets.
Okay.
And then kind of, you know, filled in places, you know, here and there, you know, again, just taking some creative license a little bit, but not much, actually. Most of that was either what was reported that Helmut actually said to the judge, including his final words to the judge, or from his leaflets, things that he had written in his leaflets.
Wow. Yeah. Now that the film, it's coming out tomorrow, there is the four-hour streaming version, the four-part series that people can find on the Angel streaming app. What did you take away from this project for yourself and as a filmmaker that you can take forward into future projects and even into life?
Such a great question. I'll say as a filmmaker, I've really, this getting this story told, to be perfectly honest with you, has consumed me for many years. And so, yes, I've been working on other small things here and there, but it really, everything has been trying to point me to be able to do this story justice and try and tell a beautiful story that would make those boys proud, and that would hopefully, you know, share those last words that Helmut says to his friends in their final goodbye, when he says, remember me, those were his last words. Yeah. Those were his last words, to them. And so I hope to be able to have made something that will honor Helmut's last request. You know, Carl and Rudy spent the rest of their lives trying to do that, sharing his story, sharing their experiences, writing books about it. And then through my friendship with Carl, I felt like what he did, he entrusted me and my team here at Kaleidoscope to continue to help people remember Helmut. And so I hope that's what we've done. As a filmmaker, you know, I hope to tell more stories. I know what I want my next one to be, and it's related to the story we just told. But on a personal level, you know, since I found this story, I've repeatedly been asking myself a question, and it is, what would I have done?
Yeah.
And then what will I do now? And if people can walk away from that, from this film, asking that question, I think that would be a good thing. I definitely am asking myself that question and then trying to make decisions. You know, I'm not a big courageous person by nature, I think. You know, I don't know that I would have done what Helmut did. but I can, thankfully, I don't live in Nazi Germany yet.
Yeah.
But hopefully when I see someone who's being mistreated, instead of thinking to myself, oh, somebody should do something about that, hopefully I'll be that person to just go over and say, hang on, you know, and stand up for someone. I'm sure you captured that repeated theme throughout of people having the opportunity to stand up.
Yep.
To take a stand. And which is, of course, fulfilled literally when Helmut sets down that confession statement and literally rises to his feet. I hope that I can have become someone who's more courageous in that respect in my life.
And I hope that people fully realize that Helmut was only 16 years old when he started this. Yeah. And he was executed at 17.
Unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah. Talk about courage. Courage under fire. Yeah. An amazing, amazing story, Matt. I am so glad that you have made this into a film. I can't wait to watch the 4-part series. Truly a remarkable, remarkable production.
So, thank you. It means so much to hear that. I'm so grateful.
And I can't wait to see what you do next so I can talk to you again.
The scripts are in the works. If you saw the end of the film, I'll just give you a little tease if I can.
Okay.
Right in the epilogue.
Yes.
When it's telling kind of what's happened to these, and you saw that story, it says that, you know, Carl was forced into the German army 2 weeks before the war ended.
Yep.
And was captured, and then was a prisoner of war in Russia for 4 more years. The story that Carl shared with me of that experience is incredible. Incredible. His journey toward a miraculous, impossible forgiveness is something that I'll never be able to forget it, and it's the next story that I want to tell. We have an incredible young actor who is so ready to keep moving forward on that. So that's the next one I'd like to tell, but of course a lot of it will depend on how this one does.
And everybody has to watch the film through the credits because of the epilogue that we get. But yeah, when I saw that 2 weeks before the war ended, Carl was pulled from prison and forced into the German army and then captured and spent the next 4 years as a POW in a Russian camp. I'm like, oh my God, how much more can you endure?
Yeah.
Just
there's an incredible story there.
Well, I hope you get to make it because I want to hear about that story.
I hope I do too, Debbie.
Oh. Matt, I can't thank you enough for taking time to talk with me today about Truth and Treason. It's an important film. It's an important story that needed to be told about Helmut and Carl and Rudy. People need to see it. That's the bottom line. They need to see it.
Thank you.
I'm just blown away by it. And so here's to talking again sooner rather than later, and hopefully about Carl.
That sounds great. I look forward to it already. It's a pleasure to talk with a fellow cinephile, somebody who I obviously loves this craft.
So, I do.
Thank you.
Thank you, Matt. And you have a great rest of your day and a wonderful opening day tomorrow.
Thank you so much, Debbie. We'll hopefully talk to you soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that was Matt Whitaker discussing Truth and Treason. And as I said, the film is currently in theaters, while the 4-part series that goes beyond the film is streaming on Angel.com. And, of course, that is all the time we have this week. I'll be back next week talking about some new indie releases with some more interesting interviews. And until then, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.